right, everyone. It's Thursday, November 21st. You're tuned into The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. It's kind of dampish out there. Nothing to note. Except I am going to say something. I had to say goodbye to my daughter and my new son-in-law this morning because they go back to China. And that was, I have to admit, it was really hard. But you know what she did? She was really cute. So my second husband has two grandchildren, I guess. Can I call them my grandchildren? I'm going to call them my grandchildren.
Yeah.
Because they are. They are. Mm-hmm. Anyway, and Martin and Redmond. And so Melissa wanted to give them a gift. And while she was not able to see them, she left the books with me and we left them at the house. So she is teaching in China and she teaches English as a second language. And there are teachers that come in from all over the world. They come in from England. They come in from Singapore. They come in from Portugal, whatever. But what she loves about the fact that it's such an international group of teachers is that each of the teachers brings their knowledge and their books from their country to share with the students in China.
Mm.
So she has a series of books from England for children about robbers and cops that mm-hmm. is hilarious. And it's done in rhyme. And the pictures are beautiful. And it's so fun. And so she brought them two from the series to give to them. And she says, this is what I love about where I teach. Mm. I would never have known about these books. I would never have read them. She said, and I offer my Chinese students this whole variety of material. And like, these were their faves. And I'm like, oh my God. So I want to, in a lot of ways, not only give it to my grandsons, but I want to give it to the elementary school because I want them to be aware of these books because,
yeah.
again, we don't look at the world that way. And every time she comes home, she does live my dreams. You know, I talk to the world on a microphone and she goes to the world with her life and then she brings it home for me. So I just want people to know I'm going to find out the name of the series. I'm going to post it on both my Facebook page, personally on the Attitudes Facebook page. But they may be books you want to check out. It may be books you want to give to your grandkids, your own children. And I just recommend that sometimes it's another way for us to tie the world together is reading other people's children's books. So there you go. That was what she gave.
Yeah, it was great.
It was wonderful. It was wonderful. Anyway, what's floating your boat today, Mr. Barnes?
Floating my boat are several things. Last night's debate was uplifting for me in some ways because issues got talked about that mm-hmm. don't often get talked about.
Yeah.
And one, of course, that's near and dear to my heart is the immigration crisis on the border
oh, yeah.
and the mistreatment, the heartless, cruel treatment
by this
administration. And Elizabeth Warren was terrific on that. And
Bernie talked about the Palestinians.
And that's the second thing.
Yeah,
absolutely.
No,
you know me too well.
I mean, I do.
Yeah. And Bernie talked about in the context of talking also like Elizabeth did about how our policy, foreign and domestic, should care about all human beings and treat mm-hmm. them all like they're members of our greater mm-hmm. human family. He talked about, well, yeah, Palestinians too. I'm a Jew. I greatly support Israel and its right to exist and be secure. But just like criticizing the United States, I have to call a spade in Israel. What the Israeli government, Netanyahu government, is doing to Palestinians is inhumane. And
totally
so
inhumane.
Him calling that out and Elizabeth talking about the immigrants, you know, Arnie, last week when she was filing her papers, remember, I think I told you, I went through the selfie line mm-hmm. in part because I really wanted to thank her for having gone down to the border when she was at the first debate at Homestead
right.
and going to actually see these children, not the border, but
right. the detention centers. Yeah, exactly.
Where the children are in jail. And she was very moved by it. She brought a lot of supporters and
press attention. And her description of the cages and her description of the warehouse. And
yeah,
I mean, again,
you betcha.
It's uh-huh. there were a lot of topics that are not historically produced. But so I out of curiosity, we're going to be talking with Glenn Smith, who ran the campaign for the governor of Texas, Ann Richards. And we're also going to be talking with Mark Fernald.
Yeah.
I'm kind of curious, as you looked, I mean, I have to tell you, I did fall asleep for 15 minutes in the middle of the two-hour debate. Oh, I've been watching all day. I've been watching impeachment hearings.
Yeah,
I've
yeah.
been up. I mean, just it's like, and then I went, oh, my God, oh, my God. So I missed some of it. But I have to tell you, he keeps being so compelling, and I know that my good friend Bill Curry does not necessarily trust him. And that is every time I hear Cory Booker,
yeah.
I am moved.
Yeah.
I am moved. I am compelled. I am emotional. I mean, when he was commenting about John Lewis and how he saw him.
Boy.
I mean, it was just – it was – I mean – and but this is every time, people. I don't understand why he has not generated any kind of connection. And nobody is perfect. I got some issues with Elizabeth Warren. I got some issues with Bernie. I got some issues with Amy Klobuchar. Trust me, I got issues with Mayor Pete. I probably have issues – I do have issues with Cory Booker. But in the end, when I think about – who inspires me whenever he talks? In a lot of ways, the way Barack Obama inspired me, it is him. Above and beyond everyone on that stage.
Me too. And I've said it before, I'll say it again, but I think that a combination of Elizabeth Warren with Cory Booker on the ticket would be a wonderful face to put forward for the Democratic Party because Cory is so compelling about our hearts and what is America about, and
but in which the order?
Principles and ethics, and Elizabeth with the substantive plans.
I understand. And I actually, believe it or not, I actually think Elizabeth is better as second than she is as first. And let me just say, so last night, having heard them over and over and over again, I mean, Bernie is, he's the old shtick. He's the old shoe. It's the same thing all the time.
But it's a good thing.
Trust me, it's not that it's not a good thing, but it's the same thing.
Yeah.
And the other thing is that there's more to being a president than having a plan for this. And every time she's asked a question, she doesn't go to the answer. She goes to her plan. And in the end, I think you have to also give an answer. You can then say, and I have a plan, but this is the answer. And she doesn't do the answer anymore. And I want to give her a knuckle sandwich. Well, I just want her to say, just answer the question and say, and I've thought so much about this issue that this is one of the plans that would help us respond to addressing it. But she always goes right to the plan, and I'm sorry, but I need more.
Yeah, I would submit that her plan is a very good answer to the question in a lot of cases, but you're right. I think she should start maybe with some more context about what the issue, why it's meaningful to ordinary Americans.
Exactly,
yeah,
exactly.
Yeah,
I don't live policy, although I'm affected by policy.
Right, but at least when she answers questions, including her plans, she has something substantive to answer the question because most of the candidates up there are not putting forward a plan. You know, there's no substance there. I'm in support of health care for all. I'm in support of the living wage for families. I'm in support of
Ukrainians
being our allies.
I know, but I'm going to remind you that in New Hampshire especially,
but what are you going to do about it
really
important,
exactly,
and none
exactly
of them speaks to it.
Well, and the other thing is that she needs to remind people, and Bernie needs to remind people, and Bernie gets this better than anyone else. Bernie voted for the Affordable Care Act, everyone. Bernie wickedly supported the Affordable Care Act. Once it was the only plan in front of him and he knew it would move the ball, he didn't say, oh, it's not what I want, Medicare for all. I'm going to support this. People need to understand when they lay out their plans or they put out their vision or they say, this is the mountain I want to climb. It doesn't mean you always get to the top.
Right.
But it means you climb the damn mountain and at least just start with the idea that you're going up the mountain. What we do when we start with nothing, but I'm going to massage what's there, I don't want the freaking status quo. I want something more. And they need to remind people, I am setting a goal. Does that mean we all get to goal? But it does mean that we're moving in that direction. You know what someone once reminded me? They said, you know who you are, Arnie? You're our Moses. Do you know why I cried? Because Moses never got to the promised land. I just want to remind you, Moses knew where to go.
Right.
He led the people to where to go. Yeah.
And I would suggest to you that that's exactly why Sanders and Warren are starting off with a vision for maybe not what we want to do the day after we're elected because we know it's politically impossible.
Right.
But let's at least have a vision out there for where the promised land, where we want to get to.
And the vision shouldn't be running in place and massaging what's in place.
Right.
Yes, right. I agree.
And in terms of Bernie voting for the ACA, of course, you know, that was a tremendous accomplishment given what the Senate was.
So we're going to be joined in 2 seconds by two of our favorite guests. Glenn Smith is joining us from Texas. Mark Fernald is joining us from New Hampshire, where you're talking about last night's debate. But as I promised everyone, I am going to begin every day until Thanksgiving reading out loud the words of Lieutenant Colonel Vidman. It is a civics lesson. It is what makes us Americans. It is the best kind of example of patriotism. Alexander Vindman, the uniform I wear today is that of the United States Army. The members of our all-volunteer force are made up of a patchwork of people from all ethnicities, regions, socioeconomic backgrounds who come together under a common oath to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States. We do not serve any political party. We serve the nation.
I am humbled to come before you today as one of many who serve in the most distinguished and able military in the world. The Army is the only profession I have ever known. As a young man, I decided I wanted to spend my life serving this nation. It gave my family refuge from an authoritarian repression. For the last 20 years, it has been an honor to represent and protect this great country. And then Vindman goes on to say, next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he has ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer life. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served and are currently serving in the military. In fact, my little brother sits behind me today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's history and our story in America. I also recognize that my simple act of appearing here today, just like the courage of my colleagues who have also truthfully testified before this committee, would not be tolerated in many places around the world. In Russia, I just lost someone, so I just want to let you know I just may have lost one of our guests, so you may want to reconnect. I just apologize, everyone. I also recognize that my simple act of appearing here today, just like the courage of my colleagues who have also truthfully testified before this committee, would not be tolerated in many places around the world. In Russia, my act of expressing concern to the chain of command is an official private in an official private channel would have severe personal and professional repercussions. But offering public testimony involving the president would surely cost me my life. I am grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant where we can live free, free of fear, for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I am sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals. It is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union, come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. So that was Colonel Vindman. I have been reading it every single day since he gave that testimony. I think it is incredibly powerful, incredibly important. And I want to remind my audience once again that right after he made that statement, the New York Times came out with a story that said the military is so worried about Colonel Vindman's life that they're thinking about moving him and his family to a military base. God help us. All right. Now, joining us by phone are two people who I'd love to talk to. Glenn Smith is from Texas. Glenn Smith has a long political history, and he began one of his, I think, most important campaigns working for the great Governor Ann Richards of Texas. And joining us by phone from the great state of New Hampshire is a former two-term candidate for governor in the state of New Hampshire, as well as a former state senator and attorney, Mark Fernald. So welcome to the program, gentlemen. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Glenn,
happy
are you there?
To be here.
All right. I'll start with Texas and then move to New Hampshire. So, Glenn, I did fall asleep for 15 minutes in that two-hour, maybe almost three-hour debate, so I apologize if I missed something. But it was a very different debate. They definitely did cover different topics. And I think the assessments I've seen is I'm not sure anybody won last night. I'm not sure anybody sort of succeeded in punching out. And you really did see the strengths of all the candidates up there. But that was kind of my assessment. I also saw what I think is perceived weakness, but I'm kind of curious as to how you look at that 10 conga line of candidates and where you saw them sorting out.
Well, I was very happy to see and Kamala Harris, Cory Booker did really well, I thought. Amy Klobuchar did very well. I think they had more shining moments than those above them in the polls. But I say that kind of like I like to mix them up. I mean, yeah. I'm not ready for this, for these candidates to sort out into a smaller and smaller group yet. They all have such strengths. They're different strengths.
Oh, my God.
But I'd like to see this contest go on among them. So I was happy to see those that are polling a little less than the others be so strong last night. And I think they were, and I think that's healthy. And it's good for the Democrats generally.
Before I flip to Mark, I'm just sort of curious. So we know that the front runner in places like South Carolina, by a long shot, is Vice President Biden. How did you think Joe did last night?
Oh, gosh, you know.
I have to ask, honey. There's no choice.
I know and love Joe Biden. He's just, let's just say he's a little less electric than I would like him to be out there.
Oh, my God.
He and his gaffe with regard to Senator Harris, I think, was any other day than after multiple hours of impeachment hearings and a long debate, which most watchers were pretty bleary-eyed, I'm sure. In any other
I was totally time,
yeah. I think that would be the news out of the debate, frankly.
Yeah. So, Mark, I want everyone to know that you've already endorsed Mayor Pete, but that is, as Ken said, but you're asking him to come on? I said, of course, I value his opinion. So you got to watch a very interesting debate last night, especially that you are a supporter of Mayor Pete, because Tulsi Gabbard spent a lot of time attacking him. Tell me your assessment of what you saw at that field.
Well, I thought the debate was interesting. I don't understand people who say, oh, these debates are boring.
Yeah,
I thought there was a lot going on. I'm sorry, were you asking me about Mayor Pete or just the debate in general?
Well, I mean, both. I just needed to let people know that you've already made a public announcement about your support for Mayor Pete, so I need to have full disclosure here, but that doesn't mean that you can't be, you know, sort of step back and still assess. I know I'm always capable of doing that.
Well, so let me start at the top and give a few brief comments. I listened to the debate. I was waiting for Mayor Pete to really shine. And I thought the place where he did was when he was asked a question about how do you overcome centuries of racism. And he spoke about his faith, and he spoke about being a minority himself, and about the people who were not gay but fought for gay rights, and how much that meant to him, and how he, as a white person, can fight for the rights of minorities. And I thought it was just an amazing answer. I don't know if other people felt the same way. I was concerned about some places where the Vice President Biden, you know, botched some of the things he meant to say, which has been a pattern. I've always liked Amy Klobuchar. I know some people don't. I think she gives good answers and is clearly an intelligent woman. I mean, I would say I like pretty much all of them. I think they're all great people.
Yeah.
And really the question is, who's the person who should lead the party? Who's best able to do that? And I am concerned that our goal as a party is universal health care, but some candidates have decided they've already got the answer. It's Medicare for all, and other options don't work, even though countries like Germany don't have single-payer systems.
Yes,
so
exactly.
We don't have to do it.
This is really interesting. So Mark and Glenn, this is the one thing I really get upset about with the questioners. And you know, there were definitely different questions. But let's go to the Medicare for all question. Why has not one of the debate moderators said to Elizabeth Warren and to Bernie Sanders? So the Swiss have a really effective system where it's much cheaper, it's more accessible, but it isn't the kind of Medicare for all. The British have a system. It's not the same. The French have a system. The Germans have a system. And they have done it better, but they haven't necessarily done it your way. Would you be willing to consider the German system? Would you be willing to go to the Swiss system? Because we know that it's more affordable, people are healthier, yada, yada. And nobody has ever said that, Glenn. So
yeah.
We think that it's a black and white choice. Either we got insurance or we got Medicare for all. Horse crap, Glenn. That's just not true. And yet I think it's the moderator's job to sort of push them to say, so what's wrong with those systems? Am I right, Glenn?
No, I think you're completely right. I'm afraid it's got to be sort of somewhat of a fight on the very liberal side, let's say, over who could be furthest that way.
Yep.
So it was ideologically driven.
Yes.
They had to use the catchphrase Medicare for all. That was almost without regard to other alternatives. I also agree with Mark that didacticism, that absolutism doesn't sell. It's never sold. It's not what the Democrats are all about.
Medicare for all is a catchphrase the way the Green New Deal is a catchphrase, without people delving into the details.
Well,
I totally agree with that.
Right. Holly, Ken wants to weigh in here. Yes, Ken. Really.
I wonder if any of you heard Elizabeth Warren last night sounding like she was backing off from the didactic position.
Right.
And saying that it's my goal. Obviously, it's not something that's going to be enacted on day one, and I'm going to give people some options. And she said 3 years, I think, but, you know, people can choose, and if they like the Medicare part of it, they can do that. If they don't, they don't have to.
That's true, but what's missing? It would be so easy for them to do that they could all share is to remind voters that Trump and the Republicans have tried over and over and over again to take away the health care they have.
Right.
Good point.
Right, exactly.
ACA.
Exactly.
And they leave that unsaid and get in this little quibble over something that's not going to sell to America in the cycle of 2020, when they could be pointing out that they want to save and expand opportunities in health care for everyone, while the Republicans are trying to take what they have away.
So let me give an example that I think the American people can understand. I weigh 190 pounds, I tell the American people. My goal is to get down to 120. I got to 140. Boy, am I really looking good. I'm just telling you. I didn't get the goal. My goal was 120. I knew the direction I wanted to go. I went in that direction. I knew I needed to lose weight. I lost weight. Do I look better at 140 than I do at 170? You better believe it. And I think that's what we're going to say is Medicare for All is the goal. The goal is that people can go to a doctor when they're sick. They don't go bankrupt when they get sick. They don't have to worry about getting a second, you know, they don't have to call the insurance company and say, do I have permission for this operation? I mean, all these things that I can afford, my EpiPen. I mean, that's really what you need to say. And I wish, I mean, as Elizabeth Warren is sort of doing the backtrack, which begins to sound like Medicare for All who want it. It sounds a little bit like Mayor Pete, Mark Fernald. Mm-hmm. I wish somebody would remind everyone that in language they understand. And talking about my goal of getting to 120 pounds, but only getting to 140, people understand you still want to get to 120, but boy, you look much better. And I wish somebody would just say that so we can all find our common ground, Mark Fernald.
I agree, although I would slightly change what you said. Our goal is not Medicare for All. Our goal is universal health insurance coverage.
Mm-hmm.
Which might be Medicare for All, or it might be the German system or the Swiss system or, you know, some other choices.
But so you want, what, let me just ask this question, and Glad, maybe please weigh in here. Why do we have to use the word insurance? No. I just want to, Glenn, you tell me, why is, when I go to a doctor, I don't think insurance. I think thermometer, blood pressure, check my weight. I don't think insurance. You are now telling me, Mark Fernald, which is what so ticks me off, is that I need to use the word insurance. And if you look at insurance companies, they're not in the business of healthcare. They're in the business of profit. Why do we have to use the word insurance?
Keep in mind that 30 or 40 years ago, most people who had health insurance in America had health insurance from nonprofits.
All right.
Most of the Blue Cross system was nonprofit health insurance.
Mm-hmm.
So the for-profit you're talking about is a relatively new arrival on the American scene, and it hasn't been good, as we all know.
Exactly.
But, I mean, the reason why we use insurance is how we control risk. So Medicare for All is not insurance because, well, I guess I haven't looked into the details exactly, but I think the idea is that you really don't pay much of anything for it. So it's not like you're paying for a policy that protects you from the risk of medical bill bankruptcy.
So I got to turn to Glenn. So Glenn, when I look at public education, do I call it insurance? I just want to know.
I don't think there's any way. It's funny that you raised this issue. This is the classic George Lakoff example that he took from the sociologist Irving Goffman about where framing comes from. And framing comes from healthcare. I mean, Goffman's example was you think of a hospital, you think of a surgeon, an operating room, a nurse, an IV, and you don't necessarily in that frame think of insurance. But we got to remember, we have what's that figure? A couple hundred million people with private insurance? I don't know how you subtract it out of the frame when it's so much a part of people's lives.
Right. And I think we've been massaged into believing that that's what we want. We want insurance, you know, and it will take time for us to sort of disengage, because in the end, I keep wanting to remind people that insurance is in healthcare. Well, they're not going to understand that on day one. They may not understand that in year one, maybe in the fourth year. What they do know is they all want to get to be 65 and have Medicare.
it's really important to note that since health insurance was invented in the 1920s, And it was invented because the medical industry couldn't get its bills paid because they had treatments that were beyond the ability of people to pay for by that time.
Right.
Very so they invented insurance so that they could get their bills paid, doctors and hospitals. And guess what? We're still in that circumstance, even with insurance, where the cost of delivering health care have exceeded people's ability to pay by magnitudes now.
Right. Very good point.
And that gap has to be closed some way or the other. And we've still not really cracked the puzzle.
So when I first began the show before you guys were on, I mentioned that the person that I thought was the most powerful voice was the voice of Cory Booker. And every time I hear Cory Booker, I want to like have dinner with him. I want to learn more about him. I want to understand. He seems to me to be one of the most compelling voices out there, but he doesn't seem to be able to generate. And what's so interesting is I think he didn't get a lot of time last night, but his last speech, Mark Fernald, was such a stem winder. It was unbelievable. And I wanted to live in a world that Cory Booker envisioned. So tell me about your thoughts about sort of who sort of jumped out that way. Cory jumped out that way for me. Mark?
Well, I told you before about the Pete moment that I thought really jumped out.
Right, the sexual preference, you know, being a minority.
Because he went beyond the question and really spoke from his heart, and I thought it was great.
Anybody else have that moment for you?
Sorry?
Anyone else have that moment for you other than Mayor Pete? Or not?
Maybe it's hard for me because I'm now supporting him, so I listen to people differently than I would otherwise.
I hear you.
I mean, Tulsi Gabbard stood out because, you know, she went after people and really didn't succeed and, you know, used the time that she could have spent talking about the future instead talking about other people, which I would make the comment that in past debates, Kamala Harris has spent too much time focusing on other people rather than on her vision for the future.
So, Glenn, I'm going to end with you because I think Kamala, you mentioned Kamala at the very beginning. I think Kamala did a really good job. I think Cory did a really good job. I thought Kamala has learned not to laugh because she laughed sometimes during the debates and felt very uncomfortable. I thought she didn't attack. I thought she was substantive. I thought Kamala watched herself perform in the debates, and I think she learned from it, Glenn.
I agree with you about that. You know, I kind of have spread my little grassroots money around these candidates, but she's the one I sent a little bit more money last night while I watched her.
Mm-hmm.
She remains to me the most charismatic of the candidates. Mm-hmm. She has made these mistakes in the past, like the two of you mentioned. She's been a little bit too loose and cavalier to laugh too easily on stage.
Yes, exactly.
Not a happy way either.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought she was particularly good last night on women and African-American women. And I thought it was heartfelt. I thought it was accurate.
Yeah.
I thought it was moving. And to me, it was a moment. That's not to take away from some of the – I mean, I agree with you about Cory, too. It's like I said before, and Amy, too. It surprises me. And by the way, I do have to say I missed Julian Castro. It's too bad that Tulsi Gabbard's on that stage.
And not Julian.
And Julian Castro was not.
Yeah.
Yes, I agree with
you. That's heartbreaking to me. But anyway, I thought that I'm glad they did so well because I would like this thing to even up and I'd like to mix them up to continue for a few months. I really think it's the healthiest way for us to figure out exactly which one might be best.
Can I just ask,
are either of you feel the way Arnie and I do about Cory and all of his speeches? Because Arnie said when he finishes speaking, I thought she was going to say, I want to stand up and cheer. This is the America I believe in.
I want to live on that planet.
And I'm just wondering why you guys, because Arnie said, why doesn't the whole country give him a little more polling support? But you folks haven't really sounded like you feel the same way. Are you not inspired by him in a way that is qualitatively different from the others?
I think Mark? I come into these debates with background. I assume others do too. And so one thing that is background for me on Cory Booker
Zuckerberg.
Is that there was a bill in the Senate. I believe it was Sanders' bill. It would allow importation of pharmaceuticals from Canada. And miraculously, you know, Mitch McConnell lets it come up for a vote, probably because he knew it was going to fail, and there were a handful of Democrats who voted against it, and Cory Booker was one. And I think it's because he gets a lot of money, and he has a lot of pharmacy companies in New Jersey, And I was thinking at the time of the vote, you know, if you're running for president, you got to do what's right for the country, not what's right for New Jersey or what's right for your campaign contributions. And it just kind of really soured me on him.
So let me just say something, Glenn. So my stepdaughter is an attorney that represents pharmaceutical industry, okay, which means we have tension on occasion. Mm-hmm. So the other day I was telling her how I thought Cory did a really good job, and she goes, oh, not Cory Booker. He wants to send my people to jail. And I'm thinking, wait a minute, is this the same guy that didn't want to do the imports? I'm just, you know. So again, gentlemen, thank you so much for this. It's going to be a very, very interesting kettle of fish for the next couple of months. But between impeachment and debates, I think we're all exhausted. We'll talk to you again soon. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Ciao. Bye-bye. All right, everyone. A little labor history is next. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and Ken Barnes.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1942. That was the day the completion of the Alaskan Highway, or ALCAN, was celebrated at Soldier Summit. There had been proposals for a highway connecting the United States to Alaska since the early 1920s. After the bombing of Pearl Harbor, President Franklin Roosevelt moved quickly to organize its approval and construction. By March 1942, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers broke ground on the $138 million project. More than 10,000 troops were assigned to highway construction. Over a third were comprised of newly formed black regiments. Thousands of pieces of construction equipment were moved through the railroads, including steam shovels, blade graders, tractors, trucks, bulldozers, snowplows, cranes, and generators. In a matter of 8 months, workers carved out 1,700 miles of road between Dawson Creek, British Columbia, through the Yukon to Delta Junction in Alaska, under the most treacherous environmental conditions. Workers arrived in wintry Dawson Creek, pitching their sleeping quarters in snowdrifts. By spring, workers battled flooding rivers, equipment sinking into thick mud, and fears of Japanese bombers. By summer, mosquitoes, dubbed bush bombers, were so bad, workers had to eat under netting. Black workers also battled relentless racism. The army was still segregated. Black troops faced racial presumptions about their capacity to carry out hard labor. They were determined to break down stereotypes. By fall, white and black bulldozer drivers coordinating the work together were celebrated in the pages of the Army's Yank magazine, Time, and the New York Times. Some historians consider the integrated work crews a factor in President Truman's later move to desegregate the armed forces. According to the New York Times, the Federal Highway Administration calls the ALCAN the road to civil rights. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. When too much rain falls on farm fields, crops can rot and the soil can wash away. But with too little rain, the plants can wilt. In the Northeast U.S., both of these extremes are becoming more common. For example, in 2018,
Pennsylvania had its wettest summer on record, and then at the same time in September, it was like drought conditions in Vermont and parts of Maine, and we're just expected to see more of that.
That's Alyssa White of the University of Vermont. She led a survey of almost 200 fruit and vegetable growers about how they're adapting to these extreme weather events. She says many are now planting cover crops, which can reduce erosion and help the soil hold more water. Others are experimenting with new plant varieties or tilling the soil less.
Farmers are using a lot of different strategies.
Yet the majority of growers still feel unprepared for the increasingly extreme weather. Many say they do not have the technical skills or the financial resources to adapt. So White says that farmers need education, technical assistance, and financial support as they work to keep their crops and businesses growing. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Spider. Power is the spider.
Putin the spider, but Boris the spider will work. So who sings this?
It's The Who.
Oh, what
and
a riot.
I don't know. Listening to Fiona Hill this morning talking
morning.
About what a coherent and brilliant and totally understandable description of the big picture of how the Russians are really trying to
manipulate
our whole country
right.
and the world, and with the disinformation of their idea, oh, it's the Ukrainians, not us, who did
right.
this, and then – of course, our brilliant leader picks up on that, and
he doesn't. That's exactly right. He needed a reason to go after Ukraine, and the reason was about him once again. 1996, as if the Ukraine was responsible, but then it was a twofer because he got Joe too.
Yeah.
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah, and the idea of Boris as a spider. You know, the Russians are kind of spider-like. They're sort of on the walls and on the ceilings. They're
right.
listening
they
to us.
And they bite.
And they're biting, yeah.
And they're biting. And joining us right now, someone who does not bite, but he is everywhere. Stefan Schmidt is known affectionately as Dr. Politics. He's a professor of political science at Iowa State. And I thought that was a really good song choice, Boris the Spider. Didn't you, Stefan?
You know, I don't remember the song. I know The Who,
it's
and they're terrific, but it's a great song. I love it.
I love it, too. So I just got something off the presses. Hold on. I got to open up my listen to this. This just came in from The Wall Street Journal literally minutes ago. Huh. Prime Minister Netanyahu indicted on bribery, fraud, breach of trust. Those are just some of the charges. Boy,
those are just fake charges. It's the fake news of Israel. I mean, come on, you can't believe that.
Oh, God.
No, I saw that, too. I saw that, too. And it just comes at just the wrong time, you know. The Israeli political system is such a mess. I've always said this for years. They've got to redo their constitution and rewrite their election laws.
Yeah.
Because right now, if you have a political party that got 10 votes, in the last election to the Knesset, and you have one member to their legislature, that one member can make or break a government.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just absolutely the weakest kind of system. And right now there is a big struggle going on as to whether Bibi will get the prime ministership again or not. And so this comes, I think, at an opportune moment.
Well, and just let me say something, because not only are the most serious charges like worthy of 10 years in jail, we'll have to start measuring the jumpsuit, but this is the most important one. I just want everyone to hear this. Netanyahu is the first sitting prime minister to be indicted. Now, if we didn't have that little memoranda, Donald Trump could have been the first sitting president to be indicted as well. But, you know, but we don't indict a sitting president, but apparently you indict a sitting prime minister. Maybe we need to be more like Israel. That was my theory right now.
But the charges were, you know, corruption, you know, it was, you know, throwing some business deals to some people and stuff that, you know, it wasn't colluding with the Russians or, you know, undermining Israeli democracy or, you know, anything like that. So, not to me, not that serious. So it's interesting that they take things pretty seriously. Yeah.
Well, so I shared this with Ken before you came on the air, because obviously we'll start with the debate and then we'll go into the impeachment hearings. I was not able to hear Ambassador Hill this morning. But I posted this on Facebook and I want you to hear why. So I was watching the debate and I do agree with one of our first guests who said he thought that Mayor Pete's answer about, you know, being a gay man and about how come you can't relate to the black community and why you're polling so low within the South Carolina Democratic Party. And so he, I thought, gave a very emotional and a very sort of positive answer to that request and that question. And then after I heard him answer it, this is what I posted on Facebook, Stefan. I wrote, Mayor Pete, in 1996, South Africa became the first country in the world to constitutionally prohibit discrimination based on sexual orientation. And then I continued with a comment under my post. I said, you should take this message to voters of color in America, a country, South Africa, intimate with discrimination/apartheid, decided to address all forms of discrimination in their constitution. And I think that isn't – that is such a powerful – and that most people don't know that is not surprising.
No, I didn't know that. I
actually wrote – met a woman at Harvard who helped write the Constitution, which is why I learned about this.
Wow.
And I think this is really important. It's not that they've lived up to it, just like all men are created equal, you know. These are things that we set as a standard. We idealize that this is what we would like to be like. And when the South Africans imagine the kind of South Africa they wanted, it doesn't mean that there isn't lots of prejudice still there. It doesn't mean that they don't discriminate against people. But what it meant was, at least in their constitution, their vision was all forms of discrimination are wrong to marginalize people, whether it's for race, religion, creed, color, or sexual preference. And I think he needs to bring that to them and say, look, I'm not saying you're going to reject me because of my sexual preference. You can reject me for my issues, but at least let me walk into your space and understand we have more in common. It's our common humanity.
Yeah, but of course, that's really why African Americans are not keen on Pete. It's because he's never done anything to help African Americans. He's never done anything to deal with racial issues, the police issue in South Bend
has a police issue. I mean, I hate
sure.
to break it to you.
No, that's
and,
true.
And I
but
think
he hasn't done anything for them. So, yes, he has been discriminated against.
Yeah, keep going.
Every candidate on that platform has a race issue of some sort.
Exactly.
And I'm getting very frustrated, although I'm not a Democrat and I'm not a Republican. I can't be because of my particular media and because I'm a professor and I need to be neutral. But, you know, when African Americans reject a Democrat like Hillary Clinton because she didn't do enough for blacks, and Hillary Clinton gets defeated because African Americans didn't vote for her in enough numbers, I'm asking myself, you know, you can't always get what you want. You know, you might get what you need, because now you got Donald Trump, and is that a better outcome than having voted for Hillary Clinton?
Well,
and so the African American and black voters need to be, you know, realistic. African Americans are a small percentage of all American voters. 70% of American voters are still white. And, you know, you want a perfect candidate who caters to the African American community. You're not going to get it.
Well, let me just say something. Barack Obama was a great majestic disappointment for the black community. So I just want to let everyone remember, I mean, yes, you saw a person of color who is now president of the United States, but can we go through the list of things he did? Can you name them? I mean, in the was that for African Americans, or is that because
all Americans.
Exactly, but, exactly.
Sure, but you got to be careful. You know, you got to be careful not say, well, what has so and so ever done for
me,
Hispanic voters?
I agree.
So and so ever done for, you know, I don't know, you know, evangelicals or Catholics, and you know, if you start slicing it and dicing it down,
that's why I
want
to,
you know, that's not going to work.
Ken,
I know you're addressing what I had said about Pete, but it's not what has he ever done. It's just that what Arnie was saying was that little speech he gave last night was really about how he, as a gay person, feels kinship with the African-American discrimination experience. But that doesn't necessarily mean African-Americans are going to flock to him because he feels kinship.
No, they shouldn't. Kinship is not what you vote for someone.
Right,
sorry.
Right. And there are other people on the stage who are Democratic candidates who do speak out more for the suffering of African Americans in this country and have articulated policies to do something about it. And so if Pete is the nominee and runs against Trump, obviously we can make those points that African Americans have to come out and vote for.
Well, let me just say something. Stacey Abrams is running around the country talking about the integrity of the vote. Mm-hmm. Okay? And because she knows in part, and she did, she lost her race for governor because of the Secretary of State and how they basically really they skewed the result by basically purging so many voters. And the voters they carefully purged were probably voters that in the long run might have voted for a Stacey Abrams. So I guess the question I have is, Stefan, if I am for voter integrity, if I want same-day registration, if I want people to have a holiday on Election Day, if I want to make sure that we encourage as many people to participate in the franchise, am I doing this for blacks or am I doing this because it's good for America? Which one?
Well,
what's the answer?
Obviously, voter integrity is essential for democracy.
Exactly.
You know, it can be gay people, it can be women,
exactly.
It can be handicapped people with disabilities. Access to voting places and making it possible for as many people to vote
right.
is in the national interest above all. So yeah,
I want to go into places and say what I mean. That was the interesting thing about Elizabeth Warren when she spoke to a lot of black women in Houston, and they walked away feeling really excited about her. And she wasn't necessarily talking about black women, but she was talking about economic inequality. She was talking about bad results. She was talking about not being able to afford daycare. She was, all those things. And they heard a woman with a policy prescription that actually responded to their experience. And their experience happens to be an experience not only of a black woman, but frankly, a lot of women in this country. And I think they were able to relate to it because they said, she gets the challenge of my life. And the challenge of my life is important. Go on.
Mm-hmm. What is Joe Biden, doing for African Americans? And yet, apparently, African Americans like him better than most of the others up there. So
after last night's debate, why would you like him? He looks so.
Well, yeah, I mean,
he looks so old. I'm going to say this, everyone.
He looked out of it.
He doesn't offer answers. He offers word salads. He's, I try to follow where the answer is going because it starts in one place and ends in a different place.
Right.
And people said that he was stronger than he's been in other debate performances.
No.
And I'm thinking, no way. What debate were they watching? I know I fell asleep for 15 minutes, but did I miss the magical moment? Because I don't think I did. And I walked away so frightened by his performance.
When he talked about the first black woman senator Cory Booker kind of was looking at him and then he realized he had made a mistake and he tried to clarify. He was talking about violence against women, and what did he say?
Punch them.
He said
we've
got to punch and punch and punch at this issue. When they were talking about violence against women, using the word punch, totally out of it.
Well, but that's when he talks about taking on Donald Trump, he uses physical violence to talk about it. I mean, I don't want those words. The problem with politics in America is that it's become a war. It's become, weaponized. It's become somehow a battle. And that's not good politics. That's the worst of politics. And he's just reinforcing it using those old terms. And that's what's so scary for me, because if we're going to change the dialogue with Donald Trump, we can't use his language.
Mm-hmm. Mayor Bloomberg is going to take care of all this. He's going to surge in the polls. Black voters are going to come to him because now he has apologized for, stop and frisk in New York, and everything will be okay.
Which primary are the black voters going to vote for him?
I don't think so. I think he's delusional. He is delusional.
I think what is really important, I think it's the state of Wisconsin, one of the states in the sort of northern Midwest, is actually looking at legislation now. And while it may appear on its face to be neutral, they're looking at how it actually affects people of color and whether in the end it does a form of subtle discrimination. So they are looking at it not just saying, oh, look at these neutral words. They're looking at the lack of neutral effect. And I think that is really a challenge for all of us because to a large extent, you know, when Mayor Bloomberg did the stop and frisk, he wasn't saying stop and frisk Hispanics and blacks and poor people. But in the end, guess what they did? You know, that thousands and thousands of people were stopped and frisked. Like 90% of them had done nothing wrong. And the vast majority happened to be people of color. Well, that he could have figured that out after the first term. He could figure that out after the second term. I mean, this is part of the problem. And they didn't figure it out till last week. To me, is not an answer. That to me is something that makes him worthy of being a president.
Sure.
So let's go back to impeachment. We have to do impeachment before you leave. I did not get to hear the testimony this week, this morning. What is your reaction to what you are hearing?
Well, I mean, every single person, especially shocking the people that the Republicans thought were going to basically clear President Trump and say, you know, there's nothing here, testified that there was something really bad going on and that it was dangerous for Ukraine, dangerous for the national interest, that Russia has a huge interest in promoting this, and that Russia is thrilled that the American administration has sort of fingered Ukraine as the culprit in the interference in the U.S. elections and in the hacking of Hillary Clinton and the Democrats' emails.
It's incredible.
I mean, everybody confirmed it. And yet I was watching all of the Republicans and their comments, their attacks against the witnesses, which is the only thing that they have going for them, is to attack the witnesses and say, well, you know, you were born in Russia, in Ukraine, weren't you, Lieutenant Colonel?
God. Exactly.
And, you know, maybe there's some loyalty there. And, you know, you were offered the position of Secretary of Defense or Minister of Defense in Ukraine, weren't you, sir?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, really? A guy with a Purple Heart? All of his brothers are in the military.
Yeah.
It is really, I think, a shocking revelation. I don't think it's going to make much difference with most Republicans and certainly not Trump supporters, but I think it might have an impact on others, independent voters and others who, if they listen to this, must have been somewhat surprised that the country is so divided.
Well, I think the other thing is that the thing that I would say to undeclareds and independents and people who are still willing to make up their mind, not based on sort of, you know, following the cult of Donald, and that is that you don't like a rigged system, period. You don't like it rigged. And what Donald Trump attempted to do, and we see that the Russians sort of accommodated him, was they attempted and they, to some way, were successful in rigging the 16 election. What he was trying to do by now diverting attention away from who actually, you know, rigged the 16 election is to blame Ukraine as if Ukraine was to blame. You know, it's always, and in part, it's to rig the 2020 election. And that's what this is about. This is about rigging something. You don't want your contract rigged. You don't want your car fixed and being rigged. You don't want your election being rigged. And this is a pattern with him. It's not a one-off. It's not just he's making a statement and no one is listening. He's only making a statement like he did in 2016 with the Mueller report. But now you see him aggressively using everyone in his administration to not only place a new blame on Ukraine, but not only divert the attention from Russia to Ukraine, but basically finger Joe. I mean, it is just an rigged systems are wrong, whether it's your president, whether it's your kid, or whether it's your boss. But this is rigging an entire election that has an enormous impact on what basically the safety and security of your family and your life.
Yeah, you know, the second thing that is now so shocking is that the people who are testifying, a lot of them are part of his administration.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I mean, exactly. That's astonishing. They are being honest. They are part of his team. And then he is attacking them and saying, I don't know this person. Who is this Lieutenant Colonel? You know, I don't know who this is. And the guy, you know, is right in the White House. He probably has seen him every single day with the National Security Council. And the others who work for Vice President Pence. And, you know, those are all part of the Republican administration, and yet they're testifying that this is wrong and that this is bad. That's, I don't know as I've ever seen that in my studies of American presidents going all the way back to graduate school. It's unprecedented. It's going to be in the history books.
Well, and then the other thing I think that's also so interesting, I just heard a little snippet as I was coming in this morning about how the Americans have worked very effectively with the Ukrainians and really developed a strong and powerful military force for them, perhaps one of the most coherent, strong, and powerful military forces in all of Europe. I mean, they really are that good at what – so we were clearly successful. But the problem is successful is if you see Russia as a problem. And the problem with our president is that he sees Russia as an asset. He sees Putin as an ally. He basically knows that the only way he gets elected is if he continues to maintain a relationship with Russia. So he is literally standing alone against the entire Foreign Service, the entire State Department, frankly, even Republicans in Congress, because he sees it through a completely different lens. And as a result, that is part of the problem. When you have a president that basically is going in the opposite direction of everyone else, then the question I have for Republicans, so who are you choosing?
You need to listen to Fiona Hill's testimony this morning
is
exactly on that. It was a primer on the whole Ukraine-U.S.
relationship,
how it's in our interest to keep Ukraine looking west rather than east fighting off the Russian aggression.
Right. Anyway, Stefan, and the other thing I also heard is that if Putin is able to sort of recapture Ukraine, then they said that Russia goes back to becoming an empire. This is about empire building.
The beginning of it anyway. Chewing away little pieces,
So how do the Democrats use these powerful statements and testimonies? Can they use it, even if it doesn't mean that the Republicans will remove? My understanding is that the senator from Utah was meeting with Donald Trump today at the White House. Well, that makes me excited. So I'm just wondering what that conversation is about. Is it about he's trying to convince him to be quiet? Or is the conversation him saying, I can't take it anymore?
Yeah, I don't know, but all I know is the Democrats, all except three or four Democrats running for president, need to go home and do something else. I think right now the problem is that Trump stands alone. The Democrats basically are all over the place, and nobody knows where they're going to land and what is going to be their candidate and what the policies are going to be. And so that's a huge, huge weakness. I mean, that's a dispersal of their ability to use this, you know, as a political campaign issue.
No. I at a time when the Democrats need to be the most focused. I mean, I understand Nancy Pelosi and Adam Schiff, but they are not running for president. And the problem is all about the leadership. Thank you so much.
I was thinking Adam Schiff ought to run for president. He's been terrific.
Well, that's right. He's had more exposure than the rest of them all combined, which is unbelievable.
Yes,
I know. I love you. All right. Stefan Schmidt, officially known as Dr. Politics from Iowa State. We'll talk to you next week. Ciao.
Bye-bye.
All right. We end with?
The Situation is Out of Control by the Rolling Stones.
Totally, totally. Here we go.
I was out in the city. I was out in the rain. I was feeling downhearted, I was drinking again.